KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. If you're born on U.S. soil and you carry a U.S. passport, aren't you usually allowed to vote in elections? Well, a case playing out in a small town in Alaska suggests the right to vote is not that cut and dried. It comes down to how the federal government regards people from American Samoa. We'll hear about that and get an update on an important redistricting case the tribes say is hampering their ability to be represented. That's all right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As food insecurity rises across the country, groups fighting hunger are highlighting the need for food that is not only nutritious, but culturally relevant. Isabel Charlet has more.
Le'aloha Kaula heads the nonprofit Kalo HCC, which serves Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander communities in Oregon and Southwest Washington. The organization started distributing food boxes during the pandemic, and Kaula says the food didn't always meet people's needs because it wasn't familiar or they didn't know how to use it. In response, she says Kalo started including traditional foods in the boxes, like taro root and coconut.
It was not just hunger for food, it was that hunger for culture. It was that hunger for home. That's what was filled.
Visits to food banks in the state have risen sharply in the last year, and data shows Pacific Islander Oregonians are twice as likely to experience hunger than their white neighbors. Kaula says Kalo HCC has also started cultivating taro, a Native Hawaiian staple, and encouraging people to get involved in the project.
Even though we're here in Oregon, that's still a connection to home. It's about how we as indigenous people are caring for the land.
Amid federal cuts to food programs, Kaula says she wants to see Oregon focus more on providing culturally relevant foods so all communities in the state can thrive.
To really, truly have a healthy Oregon, we have to make sure that we're serving all the communities in a way that makes them feel seen, heard, and feed them in that way.
I'm Isabel Charlet.
In the basement of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau, Alaska, sits thousands and thousands of photographs. They were taken by a Tlingit elder who has since passed on, but for decades he documented important events and everyday life. And as KTOO's Yvonne Crumery reports, the organization wants help identifying people and places in the photos.
Kahkahu Cyril George Sr.'s family unearthed his photo collection in the wake of his death 11 years ago. His granddaughter, Lillian Woodbury, said she was astounded at the volume of photos he kept in a small Juneau condo.
That tiny little room had been harboring all of these memories he captured in photo. I mean, every time we thought, we've got them all, we pulled out another box or another container, and I'd be like, oh my God, Mom, it's another box of photos.
A family friend suggested they donate the photographs to Sea Alaska Heritage Institute to preserve and store them.
There's so much just joy in these photos. It's one of my favorite things, looking through them and seeing people just having a good time. People dancing, people talking to each other, cooking out on the beach.
That's Emily Galgano, one of the archivists who's been combing through the photos for the last several years. Some of the photos are online now. SHI hopes people will recognize some of the faces. The photos are full of life. Most are of people. Dancers in full regalia, fishing trips with strung up halibut, graduations and meetings. They show Tlingit people living, working, teaching, and making art. They show elders and babies, and elders with babies. And those babies may be elders now themselves. Tlingit photographer Brian Wallace helped SHI scan the photographs. He knew George growing up, and looking through the photos, they show how Southeast Alaska Native cultures have endured.
You know, they were thriving back then. They were thriving when he took the photos and still thriving.
Woodbury, George's granddaughter, says it was hard to part with the collection. She hopes that others, like Wallace, will look through the collection and find photos of loved ones who've passed on.
I think if people walk away seeing these photos and they feel like he gave them that one moment in time back. That makes me happy.
In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cremery.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Arctic Encounter Symposium, North America's largest Arctic policy event at the Denaina Convention Center and Anchorage Museum, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska. Registration for this global conversation at arcticencounter.com. Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org. Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. At the center of an alleged voter fraud case in Alaska is a long-standing debate over citizenship for the U.S. territory of American Samoa. A handful of American Samoans in the small town of Whittier, Alaska, are charged with voting illegally in a recent election. These are people who are born on U.S. soil, carry U.S. passports, and are eligible to serve in the U.S. military. American Samoa officially came under the authority of the United States in 1900. Today on our show, we'll talk with attorneys involved in the case and Samoan advocates about citizenship and colonial history of the territory. Later in the hour, we'll talk about racial discrimination and voting protections for Native Americans in North Dakota. We also want to hear from you, our listeners. Tell us your thoughts on citizenship for Indigenous people living in U.S. territories. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. Joining us now in Seattle, Washington, is Charles Ala'ilima. He is an attorney and is Samoan. Charlie, good morning. Welcome to Native America Calling, and please feel free to further introduce yourself.
Oh, thank you, Sean, and thank you for having me on. I'm Charles Ala'ilima, and I was born in American Samoa, but raised also in the independent state of Western Samoa and also up in Hawaii, where I went to law school and then eventually returned to American Samoa to do my legal work back in 1979. So I have been involved in American Samoan legal system for going on 45 years. My family has also given me the title Le'atoa from the Western Samoan island of Manono. So I have those obligations also, dealing with our traditions, in accordance with our customs and traditions.
Well, Charlie, thank you for that introduction, and let's go ahead and get started here. But before we get into the specifics of the case, please explain to our listeners, why can't American Samoans vote in U.S. elections?
American Samoa is a U.S. Territory, became a U.S. territory in 1900. The reason why they cannot vote in the presidential election is because their American Samoa obviously does not have an electoral vote, so there are no electors allowed from American Samoa, so American Samoa cannot vote for president. They do, however, have the ability to vote for their own local legislature and governor and delegate to Congress. However, the problem is that when they move to the states and become residents in the particular states, their status as what they would call U.S. national non-citizens creates a situation where they are, where the states require that you be a U.S. citizen to vote. There is a difficulty then, because there is a misunderstanding between what it means to be a U.S. national non-citizen and a U.S. national citizen. So this issue is created, the problem that is created is in the states, there has been very much difficulty understanding exactly whether they are entitled to vote or not vote. They have not been given citizenship status, and that is what we are trying to say. No, they are entitled to citizenship under a constitutional right of the 14th Amendment.
What rights are afforded to American Samoans who live in the States, and how is American Samoa different from other territories, for instance, like Puerto Rico?
Now, American Samoans that are born in the United States, meaning their parents are serving the military or they're born in the United States, they're U.S. citizens. American Samoans who are born of American Samoans in the territory of American Samoa are considered U.S. nationals. Now, but non-citizens. The Congress of the United States has gone around and given rights of citizenship to places like Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands and Guam and the Commonwealth of Northern Marianas, but they have not conferred citizenship by congressional act to American Samoans. The position we're taking with respect to the United States Constitution is it doesn't matter. Congress is not the one that decides your citizenship. If you are born on U.S. sovereign soil, you are, under the 14th Amendment, a U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, thank you. It does sound a little bit confusing, but let's talk more about the case in Whittier now. We have 11 people who allegedly voted in their local election. If they're not allowed by law to vote, isn't that the end of the argument?
The end of the argument would be that we are making to the underlying argument is ultimately would be they are citizens by the 14th Amendment, that Congress cannot make a statute or cannot accept people the sovereignty over an island and then basically say, but your people are not U.S. citizens. So that's the issue that we're arguing underneath. Now, with respect to this case, there are other issues, and I think Neil will give you a little more detail about other issues regarding intent, criminal intent and things of that sort that might mean that they don't have to reach the constitutional issue of the right of citizenship, but that is something that I think, so there are issues that are not involving citizenship that might decide this case.
All right. Thank you, Charlie. Let's talk more now with our next guest, Neil Weir. He joins us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. He is the co-director of Right to Democracy. Neil, hello, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Great to be on your show. Appreciate you having us on.
Absolutely. Well, I want to learn more about the defendants in this case we're talking about. Can you give us some more background? And these defendants also, did they understand the risk that they were facing by voting?
Yeah, so Charlie and I represent Tupe Smith, who was the first of 11 American Samoans who are being criminally prosecuted by the state of Alaska for voter misconduct and other charges. They're facing charges that have up to 5 to 10 years in jail. So these are serious criminal offenses that have been levied against them. And to directly answer your question, when they voted no, they didn't have any idea that it would be unlawful for them to do so. For a few different reasons. And you said earlier, this all sounds confusing. And that's because it really absolutely is. And it's even more confusing to Alaska election officials and other public officials who don't know about American Samoa or non-citizen national status. And so in Alaska, there is a public benefit called the Permanent Fund Dividend that American Samoans are eligible to apply for. Under Alaska law, if you do that, you're automatically registered to vote. And receive a voter registration card, whether you're a U.S. Citizen or a non-citizen U.S. national. Officials in Whittier itself for many years have understood that American Samoans are eligible to vote and have instructed them as such. Our client, Tupe Smith, Whenever she did vote, she actually would ask the officials, say, you know, look, I'm a U.S. national born in American Samoa. Is it okay that I vote? And they would say, go ahead and check the citizen box and go ahead and vote. So she was just following the instructions she was given by public officials in Alaska. She had no reason to think that what she was doing was not lawful. In fact, she was someone, and their entire family is very involved in the community in Whittier, Alaska. She volunteered at her local schools. They actually asked her to run for the local school board. She did. She won with 95% of the vote. And then just a few weeks later, there was a knock on her door. It was the Alaska State Troopers there to arrest her. They arrested her in front of her small children, walked her out of the apartment building in which she and about 80% of the town residents live, took her in a police car through the tunnel which connects the rest of Alaska to Whittier and where Tupé and her husband and family, many of them work, to a police or a processing facility about an hour and a half away, where they actually strip searched her and forced her to wear a prison uniform. So she went from one day being elected to the school board to the next day being treated like a criminal, like a dangerous criminal, and facing that embarrassment and humiliation in her community.
All right, Neil, thank you for that additional information. We're going to take a short break here. We're going to come back and continue the conversation. But I do want to let our listeners know that we reached out to the Alaska Attorney General's office for this show, and we received a statement from Deputy Attorney General John Skidmore. He said, "To be clear, you must be a citizen to vote in Alaska in any election, federal, state, or local." The statement goes on, "While U.S. nationals enjoy many benefits and rights, only U.S. citizens can vote in Alaska and many other states. The people in U.S. territories who are granted U.S. citizenship is a matter of federal law. U.S. citizenship is not granted automatically to people born in American Samoa and the Swains Island. However, people from Puerto Rico, the Marianas, Guam, and the Northern Mariana Islands, and the U.S. Virgin Islands do automatically acquire U.S. citizenship at birth." If you'd like to join this conversation, if you have thoughts, if you have insights, give us a call. We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-99-NATIVE. That's the number to call to join today's conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Politically motivated attacks on legislators in Minnesota has public officials all over the country on high alert. It's the latest reminder of increasing political violence in a time of severe partisan divide. We'll hear how Native lawmakers and others view the latest violence. We'll also get an update on a theater production many Navajos consider offensive. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Thanks for tuning in today to Native America Calling. We're hearing about a felony voter fraud case in Alaska that highlights citizenship questions for one of the United States territories. American Samoa is considered U.S. soil. Its citizens can serve in the U.S. military, but their rights do not extend to voting in local or national elections in U.S. states. You can join this conversation by calling in today at 1-800-996-2848. We have Neil Weir on the line. He is the co-director of Right to Democracy. And Neil, like I just mentioned here, some of the American Samoan defendants in this lawsuit, they're facing felony charges. What exactly are they charged with?
So they're charged with a number of different offenses. The main one is voter misconduct, which is a Class C felony in the state of Alaska that faces criminal sentences of up to 5 years per offense. Some of the other defendants have also been charged with perjury or falsification of records. And all this is grounded on the idea that when they checked the box saying they were a U.S. citizen on voter registration forms, that in Alaska's view is a crime. And Alaska has taken the position in the case that even if they were told by public officials to check that box, and even if they understood and believed that they were eligible to vote, that that would still be a felony. Now that's an issue of what's known as criminal intent. And that is an issue that's currently being brought before the Alaska Court of Appeals in Tupé's case. And so the Alaska Court of Appeals is right now considering whether the criminal statute for voter misconduct requires an intent to mislead or deceive, as is often required in other states, or if it's simply enough that a person knew that they were not a citizen when they checked that box, again, even if they were told to do so by a public official. And so we'll have answers to that question in the coming months. And then after that, these broader questions about whether people born on U.S. soil in American Samoa have a 14th Amendment constitutional right to citizenship will then be addressed.
And that 14th Amendment right that you mentioned, is that really ultimately what's at stake with this case?
That's a key issue. Alaska has the burden to show that these individuals are not U.S. citizens, and we don't believe that's a burden they will be able to show. The 14th Amendment says if you were born, quote, in the United States, you have a right to U.S. citizenship, regardless what Congress says, regardless what a state official says, regardless what the President of the United States says. And that's an issue before the U.S. Supreme Court right now related to children born to undocumented immigrants. But this idea that American Samoa, which has now been part of the United States for 125 years, which President Trump recently called beloved islands in his address to them on that 125th anniversary, the idea that they're not in the United States just doesn't pass the smell test. American Samoa is on the back of U.S. quarters. They're on stamps. They have the highest rate of military service of any state or territory in the United States. The idea that they're not in the United States in 2025 just defies all logic. And we look forward to having those arguments in court and having them considered as part of these arguments that, from Alaska's perspective, these individuals should go to jail despite being born on U.S. soil, recognized as U.S. citizens, and even being told by public officials that they are eligible to and should vote.
All right, Neil, I have another guest that I want to bring into the conversation, but I want to ask you one more question first, because I think it's important to note that Whittier is not like other towns in Alaska. Can you describe the town for us and why that influences this case in particular?
Yeah, Whittier is a really special place. To get there from the rest of Alaska, you have to travel through a 2.5-mile long one-way tunnel. where Tupe Smith actually works, as well as her husband, Michael Pesce. And on one side of the mountains, it could be a rainy day. On the other side, once you get into Whittier, it could be a beautiful sunny day. They're completely different climates, even just though they're miles apart from each other. It's a port town, has access to some of the most beautiful, amazing glaciers in the world, some of the best fishing. And almost all of the residents of Whittier live together in one apartment complex, which is attached to the local school. And so this is a small, tight-knit community with a large percentage of Samoan and other Pacific Islanders. About 70 out of the 250 or so residents are Samoan. For the school children, more than 50% of the school children are Samoan, which is why they asked Tupe to serve on the school board. They're an integral part of that community, valued by the other residents. And the fact that they are being criminally targeted by the state was a surprise to leaders in that community, and they've been very upset by that as well. So it's a special place. It's a community-minded place where Tupe and her family are a key part, and they feel like they have gone from being valued members of that community to being treated like criminals.
I thank you, Neil. Let's learn more about Tupe Smith. And to do that, I want to introduce our third guest who joins us now from Anchorage, Alaska, Tafilisau Noah Taliafoa. She is the executive director of the Pacific Community of Alaska, and she is Samoan. Tafi, good morning, and welcome to Native America Calling. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Hello, Falawa. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, you know Tupe Smith. You know other defendants as well in this case that we're talking about. Tell us more about Tupe. She ran for school board in Whittier and won overwhelmingly. What can you tell us about her and her motivation to run for office?
So, just a quick introduction for myself. My name is Tafilisau Noah Taliafoa. I serve as executive director of the Pacific Community of Alaska. I was born in the independent state of Samoa, but raised in American Samoa. I've been living in Alaska for over 21 years now, and community in Alaska, the Native Hawaiian Pacific Island community in Alaska, is the reason why I do what I do. So going back to your question about Tupe, she is the mother of two children. A lot of her nephews and her son, they all attend the school out in Whittier. It is, as Neil was saying, it is over 50% of the children in the school, of the students in the school, are Native Hawaiian Pacific Islanders. I've been to the school, and I see so many of our young people who also speak our language in that school. When it came to the administration, from administration to professors, I mean to the teachers and the school board, it does not reflect the school population. And so what happened was Tupe was asked, and actually she came forward, right, as someone who was willing to be the voice of these young people who were, you know, represented in the school, overly represented in the school, in decision making. And so when she did that, she's been criminalized for it. And it just blows my mind that this is happening in Alaska. And I just hope that this could be just, you know, it's change. So.
Mm-hmm. What has she told you? How does she feel about this? And what's her biggest concern going forward?
Well, what she shared with me was her personal experience of the day that it happened. And being a mom myself, I related to her being arrested in front of your child and then being, you know, put into the police car handcuffed, you know, like you're a criminal, like shortly after you won an election and and like in front of your whole community, understanding that this building that everyone lives in, like, you know, 80 to 90% of the residents live in this one building. And so like, I understand like the shame that came along with that. And then being like taken from Whittier all the way to the Eagle River facility. And you know, just that embarrassment. And then also like within the community, and also like the, like her biggest concern was that like her child, right, her son, like saw what was happening, her family scrambled to try and support her and help her. So like just the impact of that. And that is the fear that I know a lot of like the rest of the group that is in this case also feel. Like they fear for like whenever officials show up in Whittier, they're like, okay, are they now here to take us? Right? Are they here to arrest us? And okay. So I think that's and living in here is just not the right way to live. Right? You're not living anymore. And so I would just
Yeah,
the impact of what's going on.
And for someone listening to the show right now, I think they can certainly relate to the fear, but also these questions and this confusion, because, okay, let's, for somebody who is born in the States here and is a U.S. citizen, it sounds very complex. So I'm just thinking, for someone from American Samoa who comes to the States, and now they learn that they have certain rights and privileges, but not all rights and privileges of U.S. citizens. How do they figure that out? Where can they go to get that kind of information to know, hey, am I eligible to vote in this election or not?
Yeah, and I mean, this is the reason why organizations like our organization, like there's other organizations, like nonprofit organizations that are working for the betterment of Native Hawaiian Pacific Islanders across the state and across the nation. And part of that is that you have a U.S. passport, you're issued a U.S. passport, and then you have a birth certificate that on your birth certificate, it clearly says American, right? But obviously it's an American Samoa. And so when you go to get an ID or go get a driver's license, like acknowledging that you exist is one of the issues, right? That the status as a non-US citizen, US national, does not exist on forms, right? Across the states, right? And including Alaska. Right? And so you would only have two options, U.S. citizen and U.S. national. So when you go into these, like, state, you know, to get an ID or to get a driver's license from the Department of Motor Vehicle, you're asked for your Social Security, right? You get your Social Security, American Samoans get Social Security. You're issued a U.S. passport, a birth certificate that says American Samoa. You would think that equals U.S. citizen, right? Mm-hmm. And so people have been told when they fill out these applications that, oh, well, it says American, so I guess you're American Samoan. You have a U.S. passport. Okay, you're a citizen. So just check citizen because we don't have an option that says U.S. national,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that was what people were told, and including the permanent fund dividend. It did not have, until this year, the U.S. national, non-U.S. citizen was now added to the permanent fund dividend application. But prior to that, that never happened. And so for me, we have a lot of hundreds of American Samoans that have, you know, voter registration cards to vote, right, and may have voted in the past. And so the impact of these cases will affect so many more than just the 10 folks plus 2/5.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tafi. I want to go back to Charlie Ala'ilima for a little bit more insight into some of the history that what we're talking about today is based on. And Charlie, the U.S. has claimed American Samoa a territory for 125 years. What's been the evolution of the citizenship debate in that time?
What you go back to is what Samoa was before 1900, before the Americans took over. It used to be recognized as one sovereign, the whole archipelago, both West Independent and American Samoa, used to be recognized as one sovereign. However, because of internal disputes among the chiefs, and also because of the big power fighting, the great powers of U.S., Germany, and Britain decided they were no longer going to recognize that independent sovereignty of the entire archipelago, and then just said divide up the islands between themselves. So Germany got the bigger islands of Western Samoa, which eventually became independent Samoa, and American Samoa became the part of the United States. Now, the American Samoans in 1900, in American Samoa, especially because of the harbor, the chiefs that had a long, of those, that harbor area had a long-term relationship with the U.S., and they wanted to become part of the U.S. so that when the Navy came in, they signed these deeds of cession, which clearly deeded full sovereignty of the islands to the United States. And so the chiefs then thought they were citizens of the United States, only to be told a number of years later, oh, you're really not citizens of the United States because of this Supreme Court decision called the Insular Cases that said you can treat those people of these islands that we've acquired, all these islands we've acquired, differently.
All right.
So in a sense, now, since that time, there had been the generations that followed, advocate for citizenship, but eventually they were told, no, you're not going to get citizenship until Congress decides that you get citizenship.
All right, Charlie, thank you for that additional clarification and some of that history as well. That's really helpful. We're going to take another break, and we will be back to continue the show. And we still have the phone lines open, folks, so you can join this conversation, 1-800-996-2848, 1-800-996-2848. That'll connect you with our studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can join our conversation.
Trickster Cultural Center in Schaumburg, Illinois hosts a youth powwow May 31st, Pride Celebration June 7th, and the National Gathering of American Indian Veterans July 18th and 19th. Info at TricksterCulturalCenter.org who support this show. Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nyeh. Did you know that one person can save up to 8 lives and heal dozens more through the gift of organ and tissue donation? Give hope to thousands of people across the U.S. waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Learn more about the power of organ, eye, and tissue donation with Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization serving all of Alaska at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org. Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo Companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
We're glad you're with us today on Native America Calling. We are hearing about disconnects when it comes to voting in the U.S., especially when it comes to indigenous people. What is the limit on encouraging voters to go to the polls? What stands in the way? Join this discussion by calling 1-800-996-2848. One of our guests, Charlie Ala'ilima, is an attorney and is also Samoan. He is in Seattle, Washington. And Charlie, I want to ask you one more question before we bring in our next guest and pivot a little bit with regard to our topics today. But you gave us the background there, going back 125 years on the citizenship question with regard to American Samoa. But it's also important to note that now not every citizen of American Samoa, as I understand it, wants U.S. citizenship. A delegate to the U.S. House of Representatives, an American Samoan delegate, doesn't support U.S. citizenship. What are the dynamics of this argument, and why would someone from American Samoa not want U.S. citizenship?
Thank you for that question, because it's an important part that I think everybody needs to understand. In my 40 years of being an attorney in American Samoa, I can see a great deal of pressures that are coming on custom and culture, and but they are brought in not by the fact of citizenship or non-citizenship, but it's just the modern culture that exists. The problem is addressing those issues requires a focus on what the problems are that are affecting land, customs, and culture. What has been happening is that it is too easy to just focus on this issue of citizenship as being the reason why we don't want citizenship, is that because it's going to affect our custom and culture. Nobody has ever been able to explain clearly what it is about citizenship in the U.S. that is going to affect the custom and culture, as opposed to what they have now. Right now, they don't have a voice in, a real voice in Congress and in the United States to affect these real issues that are affecting, that are causing problems in American Samoa. Even now, they are having this problem of the federal government coming down and saying, oh, well, we're going to allow seabed mining throughout this area, and it's creating consternation down there, but they don't recognize that it's not the, that if they had citizenship and had more rights in the politics of America, they might have more influence to deal with those issues. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, it's too easy to say, citizenship, and it's a great political tool. Oh, if you get citizenship, you'll lose your custom and culture, without explaining why, and not addressing the real issues that are causing those custom and cultures, changes in your custom and culture, which is basically the modern world.
All right. All right. Thank you, Charlie. We have a caller. This is Vicky, who is listening on KNBA in Anchorage, Alaska. Good morning, Vicky. You're on the air.
Good morning, Sean. Thank you for taking my call. I, like most people I know, don't like jury service. And the last time I had to serve on one, there was a fellow there, and he told the judge, he says, I can't serve because I'm American Samoa. And the judge says, well, that's part of the United States, and yes, you have to serve. So they made him stay. So I don't understand how they could do that. If you can't vote, I don't get it. So that's my question.
That's a really good one there, Vicky. Charlie, could you quickly respond to Nicole's question with regard to the parallels or non-parallels between jury duty and the right to vote in a U.S. election there in Alaska?
To me, that reflects the confusion. Mm-hmm. The American Samoan, if he stood up and said, I'm a U.S. national, not a U.S. citizen, right, the judge would have to, if the judge really understood the situation, may have said, no, you are excused, okay? But that is the confusion. That is the problem, is that even in the institutions, the government institutions, there is this lack of knowledge. Now that the knowledge is being imparted, okay, now the question becomes, why are they not citizens?
Right, right. Oh, geez, okay. Thank you so much, all of our guests on this important topic there with regard to this voter lawsuit there impacting American Samoan people there in Whittier, Alaska. And with that, we're going to go ahead and pivot now to a little bit different of a topic, but it still relates to Native American voter issues. And I want to bring another guest in the conversation, Nicole Donaghy, who joins us now from Bismarck, North Dakota. She is the executive director of North Dakota Native Vote, and she is Hunkpapa Lakota from Standing Rock. Nicole, hello, and welcome back to Native America Calling.
Hi, hi. Thank you for having me back on.
You bet. It's great to have you. Now, let's talk about this latest legal decision by the Federal Appeals Court. It prohibits tribal members from claiming voter discrimination against the state of North Dakota. Tell us more, Nicole. What exactly does this mean, and what are the repercussions here?
Absolutely. So the judge ruled, the district court judge ruled that private people cannot bring violations of the Voting Rights Act to court and not challenge unfair mapping of legislative districts like in North Dakota. And North Dakota Native Vote worked on redistricting back in 2021 and worked alongside tribe to advocate for split house districts on reservations so that Native American people can elect their candidate of choice and have candidates that are from the communities run for office and be able to get elected. And so the recent ruling in this case really is a hard blow to voting rights in North Dakota. And not just North Dakota, this does impact other states as well since it's a district court.
Now, is this a change in direction from what you've encountered in the past when it comes to voter discrimination?
It's a change in direction from what we worked so hard to accomplish with the redistricting. And so it'll go back to having Native American legislative districts packed into a predominantly white district, meaning that a reservation land base will be put into a larger non-Native land base where they'll have to be if our people choose to run for office, they'll be up against a non-Native potentially that usually has, you know, more recognized and, you know, lowers our chance of getting elected.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, redistricting is at the heart of this issue. How did the 2021 redistricting plan dilute Native votes?
So the redistricting plan, initially, if it had gone the way the state wanted it to, and so in North Dakota, there's no the redistricting commission or the redistricting committee is led by legislators, and so that process we feel is very not an equitable process. So North Dakota Native Vote advocated for an independent redistricting commission, and so we were never honored that wish. And so the odds were already stacked up against us. And going into the redistricting process, like I mentioned earlier, we were advocating for tribes to be their own special legislative district, meaning they'd be put into their own house district. And so through that process, it actually worked out in our favor about 50% successfully. So out of the four reservations that we advocated on behalf of becoming a legislative house district, two out of four were actually subdistricted, and so it came out in our favor at the end of that redistricting process.
Well, tell us more. What will this mean for the protection of voters against racial discrimination going forward?
So, with this recent ruling, we're going to lose the ability to keep those legislative districts that are reservation based. The North Dakota Federal Court ruled in our favor in 2023 and found that map to be discriminatory and ordered the maps to be put in place, including specifically in District 9 that includes Spirit Lake and Turtle Mountain. And so we won that legal case. But with this current ruling, that means that everything that it was prior to this past redistricting process will go back to the way it was before, where tribes are packed into a predominantly white legislative district where our communities are potentially cracked. I know there was like a certain percentage of Turtle Mountain enrolled members packed in a separate district. And so it really does hurt our opportunities to run people in a fair election and getting people that know our communities and our communities know elected in these legislative seats.
Nicole, if private people tribal members or others cannot claim voter discrimination against the state of North Dakota, who can?
I believe that the law is stating that the Department of Justice or Congress can only bring violations of the Voting Rights Act under those certain provisions that create the ability for communities of interest, such as tribes or ethnic-based communities, to bring forth these violations. And so it would take like an act of Congress, or it would take the Department of Justice to intervene when we know for certain that our communities are being packed into districts that really don't vote the same way that we do.
Now, are you seeing a larger trend when it comes to redistricting and creating rules that perhaps work against Native voter participation?
Absolutely. So Montana, we work closely with Western Native Voice in Montana, and the same issues that we saw in 2018 with the physical addressing requirement in order to vote was on the legislative, went through legislature, I believe, last year. And so there's very similar architecting of policies and laws that are being weaponized against Native American voters. So it's not creating an equal opportunity for Natives to vote when we already have higher levels of disparities when it comes to open polling places. It's making it more difficult for our people to actually engage in these elections.
Now, in the last election, North Dakota gained more representation in its legislature. What will it take to increase more Native representation in North Dakota politics?
Well, creating these maps when the redistricting committee meets again in, 2031, following the census, understanding that you do have communities of interest, such as reservations, knowing where there's higher populations of ethnic minorities, understanding these communities that have their own voting blocks, creating maps that are very representative and fairly apportioned based on the location of these communities of interest would make it more fair. Also, working alongside tribes to make sure that the boundaries are understood, that there's actual consultation between the state and the tribe, so that there are opportunities for community members to weigh in and also tribal governments to weigh in when it comes to creating these legislative maps.
Well, it sounds like your organization, North Dakota Native Vote, is already working on some of these initiatives. But tell us more about what you folks are preparing for with the upcoming midterm elections, just a little over a year away now.
Well, we are already thinking about that. So we always work with our communities. I'm from Standing Rock, but, I haven't lived there in years. And so we have a Trusted Faces, Trusted Voices model where we work with local community members and leaders that organize and create awareness and have events and, make it fun. Make it the cool thing to do is to go to vote on election day. And so we're hoping that we don't have any more blows coming our way, such as a lot of the federal rules and laws that are being created or repealed, such as the Voting Rights Act and the SAVE Act, to ensure that we don't have any more legal fights that we have to face before this coming election. And so we're monitoring, keeping our ear to the ground with what's happening in D.C., what's happening at the state level. And we're also planning to hopefully, do really well with turnout this coming election.
Nicole, I want to congratulate you. You recently won an award recognizing the work you've done on voting rights. Have you always been focused on barriers to vote that impact Native people?
So I actually came into North Dakota Native Vote as there was North Dakota Native Vote when I came into the organization. We started in 2018 to work on the voter identification law that had the ability to disenfranchise over 5,000 Native people. And so it was supposed to be a temporary gig, but seeing the need for the level of engagement and creating awareness in our communities to get people involved in these processes has always been our mission in North Dakota, at North Dakota Native Vote. And so, North Dakota Native Vote's been around since 2018, and we've always worked to build power for our Native communities.
Now, you've also been addressing the possible effects of the SAVE Act. That's a bill that would require proof of U.S. citizenship. Can you tell us what that would mean for Native voters in the state of North Dakota?
Yeah, absolutely. That does have its implications. And so roughly 1 in 5 Native Americans lack a standard form of ID. When you do need to create, get your birth certificate or get a new state ID, the closest one, for instance, in Standing Rock is 65 miles away in Bismarck to get your North Dakota ID. And so the SAVE Act does not permit tribal IDs as a proof of citizenship. And so that has many dangerous implications that would continue to disenfranchise our people. And so we've been working to create awareness on that. We've been talking to our community members, and hopefully that doesn't pass with, very many implications.
All right, Nicole, thank you for joining the conversation. Unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap this show up. We're out of time, but we had 4 guests who joined us today. I want to thank all of them. Charles Ali'ilima, Neil Weir, Tafili Saunoa, Tali Afoa, and Nicole Donaghy. Appreciate you all spending your time and sharing your expertise with our listeners here on Native America Calling today. Also, I want to acknowledge Happy Victory Day. Today is known as Victory Day among many Lakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho people. As many of you know, it was also Custer's last day. We'll be back again tomorrow to talk with Native legislators about coping in a new reality of increasing political violence. We'll also get a look at a church play that members of one tribe consider to be offensive. I'm Sean Spruce. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Good day. Guys, don't wait until you have symptoms. Regular checkups may catch health issues early, and conditions like diabetes, heart disease, liver disease, and prostate cancer are more treatable when caught early. Ask your Indian healthcare provider what health checks are recommended for your age and lifestyle. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Global leaders, policymakers, innovators, and indigenous voices will join at Arctic Encounter 2025, North America's largest Arctic policy event, at the Denaina Convention Center and Anchorage Museum, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska. This summit includes critical discussions on geopolitics and security that shape the future of the far north, builds international partnerships, and provides northern cultural experience. Registration for this global dialogue at arcticencounter.com, who support this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.